You're listening to What is a Human Being? Psalm 8, The Old Testament, Human Dignity, and Human Rights by Dr. Ian Proven. Dr. Proven is the Marshall Shepherd Professor of Biblical Studies at Regent College in Vancouver, British Columbia, and the author of Seriously Dangerous Religion, What the Old Testament Really Says and Why It Matters. This breakout session was recorded at the Apologetics Canada Conference on March 4, 2017 at Northview Community Church in Abbotsford, British Columbia.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this breakout session. My role in this session is to talk a little bit about the relationship between the broader themes of the conference and a particular part of Scripture, the Old Testament, where sometimes people have found difficulty relating these things together. And certainly, at the moment, culturally, there's a bit of a kind of attack going on in this area too. So, with that brief prelude, let me begin the thing proper. Joe, can we just get the PowerPoint up on the screen? Thanks very much. Joe has a button that he presses, and magically. Here's the quote. To control a society, you don't need to control its courts. You don't need to control its armies. All you need to do is control its stories. And it's television and Madison Avenue that's telling us most of the stories, most of the time, to most of the people. Dwayne Elgin, he's an author and a media activist. I think that's right. And if it is right, then it follows that Christians need to become ever more literate. What I mean by that is a couple of things. First, we need to be able to recognize other people's stories, the impact of those stories on us, and to resist them where we have to, because they don't tell the truth and they lead us into wrong ways of living. And the second aspect is we need to be really clear-headed about which script we are following in our Christian story, and to find new ways, always new ways of proclaiming that story so that people understand it, and so it's not drowned out by this rather relentless barrage that is pressed upon us by TV, computers, and other media. So among the things that we need to know how to respond to is the popular story told by the new atheists, as they are sometimes referred to, people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and so on. Their narrative, which I think is a very persuasive one in many people's minds in the West and in a country like Canada, their narrative goes something like this. The world would be a much better place if we could all get over our childish infatuation with God, if we could fully embrace modern empirical science as the only or best basis for true knowledge, including our knowledge of our moral obligations. Religion on this view is bad for both individuals and societies. Abandoning religion would lead on inevitably to greater happiness and fulfillment. Richard Dawkins and others were involved in the UK a number of years ago in the famous atheist bus campaign, which was an evangelistic enterprise. And they went around, and this was their slogan: there's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. So on this view, religion is the problem. Monotheistic religion in particular is a problem. It's particularly dangerous. It ought to be rejected by all right-thinking people because it requires of us devotion of the whole person to one creator, God. And in the view of the new atheist, this leads inevitably to narrow-mindedness, the oppression of people who disagree, and ultimately to violence. Now, I think these ideas have become pretty well-rooted in the post-Christian West. And if you're skeptical, can I suggest that later on today, not now, you simply carry out an internet search for the phrase Christianity is dangerous and see what happens. Or simply talk to your neighbors. because it's now part of the it's part of the iceberg under the water. Everyone knows, you know that kind of everyone knows that? Everyone knows that Christianity is a violent, repressive religion with a violent, repressive God at the heart of it. And so, this is not a God, on this view, who places very much value on human life, human dignity, human rights, human flourishing. Anti-humanist, essentially. Well, these are pretty significant charges, I think, and we certainly do need to know how to respond to them. And I'm going to offer a response to them this afternoon. It has three parts, so you can track with me. First of all, and I'm going to stick mainly with the Old Testament because that's where I think most people perceive the problem to be here. Okay. First of all, Old Testament scripture in reality presents us with an extraordinarily exalted view of the human being in God's world and demands that we take it seriously. Secondly, that it is this biblical view of humanity that has actually shaped so much of what's valued by modern people about the Western view of human dignity and human rights. And thirdly, it's very difficult to see how all of that good stuff can survive the widespread rejection of the biblical God that the new atheists are advocating for. Okay, so those are the three parts of the argument. Number one, exalted view of the human being in the Bible. Number two, it has changed the world for the better. Number three, if you begin to walk away from that, you're going to have a hard job sustaining all the things that you so passionately believe in and value. Okay, that's the argument. Here we go. Starting point, Psalm 8, verse 4, where the Bible itself asks the question, what is a human being? What is man? And I want to begin today by setting that biblical question against its ancient background, because I don't think we fully understand the radical nature of the biblical answer to this question until we understand the answers that other cultures were giving to this question back then. In particular, I'm going to focus on Mesopotamia, so where Babylon was. What did people back then in Mesopotamia believe about stuff like this? What was the cosmos about? Well, those people believed that the cosmos was fundamentally where the gods lived. That's what the cosmos was for. It was the place where the gods were, an ordered, stable place. The stability and order reflected in the cities. The cities were constructed in this way of thinking for the gods, not for us, but for the gods. Inside the cities were the temples. The temples were constructed not for us, but for the gods, right? They weren't places of worship. They were places where the gods lived. And as the main marker of that, each temple would have a cult image, an image of a particular deity in which the deity was embodied. And by being present in the image, the deity bound himself to the fertility, prosperity, and peace and justice of the city-state. The king was also at least semi-divine in Egypt. The pharaoh was completely divine. So you see where the emphasis lies. It's all about the gods, basically, in ancient Mesopotamia. Now, that raises the question, what about us? Where did we get into the picture? Our Mesopotamian sources consistently tell us that you and I were created to work, guess what, for the gods. It's a logic to this. We were created to complete the tasks that they were tired of doing for themselves. In other words, what is a human being back in Mesopotamia? A human being is a slave. Humanity is slave labor. We are the ultimate cosmic afterthought designed to meet the needs of deity. This involved participating in a very stratified hierarchical society with the king at the top, and then you come down to all the ordinary folks at the bottom, participating in the economy of the temple, looking after the king, looking after the image of the god. Everything in that culture oriented toward the gods and for the benefit of the gods. Okay, so it's a package deal. And in fact, the idea of the package deal is rather important to get a hold of here, because things like this always come as part of package deals. And that's what this slide's about. What anyone, you and I, or an ancient Egyptian or a Mesopotamian, what anybody thinks about cosmology, what the world is, and theology, what the gods are, all of that will predict what they think about anthropology, what we are, what ethics are about, how should we live, and what politics are about, which kind of society should we build. Right? If you, this is a bit of a party trick, but if you were to give me one thing that an ancient culture believed about one or two of these, I could no doubt predict what that culture believed about the other things. Right? It's always tied up. All the big stories that people tell about the cosmos are like this. The Mesopotamian example is just one example. So, it was like that in ancient Mesopotamia, and it was also like that in ancient Israel. That worldview also was a package deal. And of course, biblical faith represents, understands the cosmos, the gods, ourselves, politics and ethics, utterly differently from the people in ancient Mesopotamia. So, to illustrate this with the point we're discussing, what is a human being, biblically speaking? Well, the first thing to say is that we are not created in biblical faith to meet God's needs. In Babylon, that's the truth of it. But in biblical faith, the living God does not have needs. And his presence in the world does not depend on the satisfaction of his needs. In fact, the world in biblical faith was not created for God in the first place. God didn't need the world. The world was created for creatures, for us. It's utterly the other way around, yeah? Creatures in biblical faith do not need to feed the gods to keep them happy. In biblical faith, Genesis 1, God blesses creatures with food. No creature in Scripture, in Genesis, let's just focus on Genesis, no creature in Genesis is created as a slave of the gods. This includes human beings, and in fact, the human position in biblical faith is highly exalted. Created on the sixth day because we are the high point of the whole creation. And one of the ways that the Bible indicates that is it moves us out of being caretakers of the divine image in the ancient temple and makes us into the images. Yes? You remember what Genesis says about that? We are created in God's image. We are the image bearers of deity, of divinity. So we're not just looking after, like the priests in the temple. We are actually divine images in a temple, because actually that's how Genesis 1 and 2 portray the world. Genesis 1 and 2 picture the world as a temple, as sacred space, as a cosmic temple. It's where God lives with us. And we are his images made in his likeness, every one of us, male and female. We are like God. That's what that image-bearing language means. And this is how human beings remain in biblical faith, even after moral evil enters the world in Genesis 3. Later on, we read in Genesis 9, for example, whoever sheds somebody else's blood, so whoever murders somebody, that can only be met by the murderer's blood being shed. Why? Because in the image of God, God has made us, right? So there's an intrinsic sacred value to the human life, and that must always be remembered when things go wrong, right? It's a fundamental truth of who we are. So what does this language of image and likeness signify? It signifies a massive promotion for human beings in the ancient context. no longer slaves, but actually now, in a way, gods, in a proper way, images of God, right? Like God. So we have, in pictorial form, the image of God in Babylon and the image of God in the Bible. But you're in there too, it's not just me. You and I image God in innumerable ways, even though we're also not like God in important ways as well. But the point is, we are not lowly, we are not secondary, we're not an afterthought, we're not slaves. Nothing less will do than to say we are like God. Psalm 8 uses the same kind of exalted language in answering its own question. What is man? What is a human being that you are mindful of him? The question is prompted because the psalmist is looking at the heavens, and of course a Babylonian looking at the heavens would be looking at the home of the gods, the great gods, the sun god, the moon god, the stars. These were all deities. The person of biblical faith looking at the heavens does not see gods up there, but it's still pretty awesome. It's a pretty stunning, vast kind of enterprise. And of course, the natural question is, in the whole scheme of things, what on earth are we, and why should God be paying attention to us? That's the context of the question. So what is a human being in the context of the whole cosmos? That's the question of verse 4. And the answer in Mesopotamia is nothing. That's what a human being is, absolutely nothing. The answer Psalm 8 gives is extraordinary. You made him a little lower than, this is the NIV, and I think it's better to translate this actually as, you made him a little lower than God, I think that's right, and crowned him with glory and honor, which of course are two of the attributes commonly attributed to God in Scripture. So a little lower than God and crowned with important attributes of God. Very, very high, exalted position. And consonant with that, Psalm 8 goes on to remind us of what Genesis 1 says too, that as such we are made rulers over the works of God's hands. Our job is to exercise just governance over God's world, to look after it. And we have been raised up largely with that project in mind, as it were, right? So this is an astonishingly exalted set of images that are put around the question, the answer to the question, what is a human being? And now you can see that in the ancient context in particular, this is utterly radical. There's nothing like this in the ancient world. And in fact, there has been nothing like it ever since either. It's radical, not least because anthropology and politics are bound up intrinsically with each other. So what you think a human being is will predict the kind of society you think we should be living in. How shall we organize ourselves? It's utterly tied up with what you think we are, right? So are we all equals and image-bearing stakeholders, or are we slaves of the king? It predicts your politics, essentially. So when you get Genesis 1 and 2 and so on, and you ask, well, what's the whole kind of ethos politically? Where's this heading? There are a couple of emphases here that are awfully important for us to get our heads around. The first is that there is a tremendous humanistic emphasis in biblical faith. And I alluded to that a moment ago by saying that the gods have gone and we are now at the center of the show, right? We are the image bearers, right? There's God and there's us, and God has put us in a great position. The gods have been eliminated from the cosmos. Human beings are at the center, and each and every life is deeply significant and inviolable. And this means that, for example, biblical society should not be organized around things like human sacrifice, right? And there are laws about that. Why? Why should that be? Well, because you don't waste precious human life appeasing the gods, right? So human sacrifice is out. It means other human beings cannot take another human life without due just cause, right? So that's utterly, and we saw in Genesis 9 verse 6 how robust the response is to that, because this is a sacred, inviolable reality. It means that even the weakest members of society must be looked after and not simply abandoned to their fate. Widows and orphans and so on, right? Because they're not being measured by their strength or their wealth or whatever. They're being measured purely by the fact they are an image bearer of God, right? So they must be looked after. It means, in the Old Testament already, that even enemies should be given hospitality, and even slaves should be given rights. The book of Job and the book of Proverbs instruct us in this way. Why is that? Because enemies may be a pain in the neck, but they're image bearers of God. Slaves may well be in a position of being a slave, but intrinsically, they are image bearers of God. Now, it means a lot more than that, but that will have to do just for the moment. There's a whole biblical ethics that arises out of this. Biblical faith is a humanistic faith in the proper sense of the word. And I know the word humanism probably makes some of you nervous because we've been taught to think of it as a bad thing, and we're constantly putting that adjective secular in front of it. We know that's bad. But we invented humanism, folks, you know, and I refuse to give it up. The word secular I'm happy to let go, but humanism as such, a good thing and a biblical thing, right? It's all about the importance of human beings in this story that we're engaged in. And the second emphasis in biblical faith politically, this may surprise you, is a democratic emphasis. I don't mean by that that ancient Israel was in fact a democracy. Obviously I don't. What I mean is that the impulse of this idea of everyone being image bearers is obviously that everyone's involved in governance, yes? We all rule. It's not just the kings who rule. It's everyone, male and female, all together, who are involved in this business of the governance of and the care of the earth. However the good society is organized then, all of these truths will have to be remembered. And it's significant that in Deuteronomy 17, when the kingship in Israel is described, it's made very, very clear that the only acceptable king is somebody who comes from among us, right, is one of us, and who keeps God's law right there before him, like all the rest of us, and does not accumulate horses, women, and gold, basically, right, as the great kings of the ancient world did. It's hardly a king at all. It's more like somebody just stepping up to help you out a bit with your governance. It's not ancient kingship. So there's very severe constraints put around notions of kingship as a result of this image-bearing reality. Okay, that's the first bit of the thing. What's the biblical vision of humanness? And this brings me on to the second aspect of what I want to say. That it is this biblical view of the human being, and not some other view, that has shaped so much of what is valued by modern people about the Western way of thinking about human dignity and human rights. Where do human rights come from? Many people in the post-Christian Western world, with short memories and apparently poor educations, believe that it is self-evident that human rights should be accorded to human beings. It's simply self-evident. This view is already taken famously by the American Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, etc., etc., right? It's just, it's obvious. You don't have to justify it. It's obvious. Of course, the truth of the matter is that there's nothing at all self-evident about it. My view of what a human being is and what her rights may be is inevitably bound up with the larger set of convictions I hold about the world and about God. And as you look back through history, you do not find in cultures scattered across the world any convictions about the nature of the world and of God that could possibly give rise to the modern notion of human rights, right? Because all was package deals. So you don't find the big stories that would give rise to human rights, and you don't find human rights either, not of the kind that we mean anyway. So here's one rather pertinent example. Athens, ancient Athens, has often been called the cradle of Western democracy, and you may have been taught this. The fact is, there was nothing really democratic about Athens, actually. Athens was resolutely a hierarchical society. The only people fully involved in the politics of the city were the adult male citizens who had completed their military training. Everybody else was excluded, among them all the women and the huge number of slaves that undergirded the Athenian economy. And this was not because they had a kind of egalitarian view of society but simply screwed up. This is because their whole view of culture justified this political reality. As far as slaves are concerned, Aristotle's pretty blunt about it. Slaves and brute animals, notice the connection, cannot form a state, for they have no share in happiness or in a life of free choice. In other words, to the Athenians, it was self-evident that there ought to be slaves. Right? That was what was self-evident to the Athenians. With regard to women, the poet Hesiod, before the time of Plato and all those guys, expressed the view that women had been visited on men as a punishment by the gods because Prometheus had stolen fire from the gods. With the notable exception of Plato, later philosophers shared this pretty negative attitude towards women, and their position in Athenian society reflected that belief, inevitably so. Plato, of course, also had an ideal society in mind, and he is a bit kinder to women in this ideal vision. The trouble is he's not kind to all the rest of us in general because the Republic is a totalitarian state, so there's not much participation anyway by people of either gender. So, the human rights that people so often speak about in today's world were not regarded as self-evident in ancient Greece. Nor were they regarded as self-evident in contemporary, in ancient cultures like in India or China, and that's also true nowadays. Many parts of the world, in fact, remain untouched by any such commitments, including the Islamic parts of our world. And none of this should be surprising to us, for the governing stories in these other cultures about God and the world and so on are far far from self-evident that all people are created equal, endowed by their creator with inalienable rights. Simply doesn't show up. In fact, the American Declaration of Independence is, in all honesty, one of the most successful and most gigantic bluffs in the human intellectual history. The reason everyone thought it was self-evident was because they were all Christians. That was why they thought it was self-evident, right? It was a kind of just a... They were in a fog, I suppose. Useful, but ultimately groundless, actually. So self-evidentness just doesn't get us there. And just one last example to illustrate this. All of what I'm saying here explains why one routinely comes across stories in our news media like this one, relating to the 2009 assassination of a women's rights activist in Afghanistan. Describing the situation in Afghanistan after this lady's death, her fellow human rights campaigner said this: if you speak of human rights or women's rights in Afghanistan, you get accused of having converted to Christianity. Right? So there's a Muslim lady, and she's relating to you, giving you an example of the kind of thing we're talking about. And this leads me on to my concluding comments on the third bit of this response to the new atheist. Everything I've just been saying makes it very puzzling, really, why there should have arisen in postmodern Western culture the popular idea that biblical monotheism in particular represents a threat to freedom, to rights, and to human flourishing. that biblical faith is somehow dangerous. I think biblical faith is dangerous, but I think it's mainly dangerous to those who don't want to take other people's human dignity and rights and image bearing seriously. It's a very dangerous religion from that point of view, but I'm not really too worried about that, because that's danger in a good way. I'm much more worried about the dangers of the erosion of the Christian worldview. And I think everyone who actually does value human rights, dignity, and all the rest of it ought to be worried about this as well. Because if the truth of the matter is that the Western view of human rights, so-called, is intrinsically connected with the biblical story that has shaped historically Western culture, and if we're now eroding that very, very actively, then what happens next with regard to the rights in question? It should not be surprising to us that the right of life in the womb, or the rights of people to life at the end of life and so on, that those are, in fact, as far as I can see, have been for some time actively being eroded. Because, of course, in many ways what's happening is the culture is reverting to a pre-Christian reality. And, of course, as some of you will know, that the Stoics, for example, considered infanticide, killing small children, to be entirely unproblematic. Not just abortion, but actually infanticide. Why? Because for them, a human being was fundamentally a rational person. And a young child is not yet capable of exercising independent reason, therefore is not fully human, therefore, right? World picture, worldview, ethics, politics, all bound up. So, and I have to stop and take some Q&A for this next bit. We're in an interesting and rather tumultuous situation, I think, at the moment in the post-Christian West, where we're poised between the world that was and the world that's becoming, as it were. And the world that was marked by Christian faith and all the entailments of that. The world that is in the process of coming is kind of marked by all of that still, but kind of not. And it's rather confused, and it's not quite easy to predict. But I am prepared to make one prediction in the longer term about all of this. And it is this, that I simply don't believe that it's possible in the end, in the long term, to remain hanging on to the branch of human dignity and human rights high up the Christian tree of thought and culture, while actively encouraging other people to chop the tree down. Ultimately, this will prove impossible. The vision of human dignity and rights and all the rest of it that we've been thinking about here is intrinsic to the biblical story. It doesn't make sense without it, and it cannot long survive its rejection. If people think it through consistently. Mercifully, most people are confused and inconsistent, and this prevents things being as bad as they otherwise might be. But it's not a very robust thing to hang on to, in all honesty, to hope for continuing confusion and inconsistency. Anyway, that's where I'll stop. Thank you very much. And we'll move into my timer at the back that Joe has begun, says 12 minutes of Q&A. Is that right, Joe? Okay, thank you. So, would anyone like to chip in? Yes?
You mentioned about the Declaration of Independence, and that's more of a bluff as far as it was not, not be assumed that humans have inalienable rights.
Yeah.
However, could it be said that the human tendency with sin is to deny the obvious, though it is still a brute fact?
Yes, I mean, I think denying the obvious, denying the truth, denying all sorts of things is part of our human messed upness for sure. And the Christian tradition has always held, therefore, that although looking at the world and how things are is of some help in working out who God is and how we should live, that ultimately it's not reliable enough to be a basis for the way we set ourselves up. And that only God's special revelation actually can provide an entirely reliable basis for that. So it's not that people don't have inalienable human rights. I believe they do. I believe God gives us inalienable human rights. That's not the issue. The issue is how we know what they are. and so on, and why we should even bother with them, and all the rest of that. That's where the weakness of the "we hold these things to be self-evident" is just, it's just untrue. I mean, it only needs one person to come along and say, "It's not self-evident to me, buddy."
But is that a problem of the perceiver? So I put on world sin glasses, which I'm conceived with, but I add through my own personal sin. It blurs the reality out there.
Yes.
So what would be true if I were to remove my own obstacle that's placed, not the reality, it's not the problem of the reality, is that I've got something in place, and I take that off, I've got clear vision.
I agree. There is such a thing as objective truth and objective right, and we perceive it dimly in our natural state, as it were. We perceive it to some extent because we are still image bearers, after all, right? All the goodness has not departed the world just because of the fall. So all of that's true. But if we're going to construct anything on it, we have a big problem. Because getting agreement about what is universally true and right on the basis of empirical inquiry is impossible, right? So, yeah. Hello, Gordon.
I just want to bring in a little bit of Charles Taylor. Because in the, as you say, in the interim period between Christian theistic worldview and you have this kind of secular humanism or scientific humanism, where we hope we can kind of hold ourselves up, hold the tree up, or hold ourselves up in the tree, even though people are cutting away on the roots. Hillbank talks about the idea that you really can't have, that science was never meant to be a humanism. It was never meant to be a basis for culture. It was meant to be methodology, epistemology. And that actually what we're in now is not necessarily a secular humanism, which is the myth of our day, but actually a form of nihilism, where it's becoming the will to power. We're moving more into Nietzsche's world.
And I absolutely agree with that. I mean, I think the reason I don't want to be too hard on the "it is self-evident" that crew is because at least they're appealing to what they believe to be objective. They may be misguided, but they're trying to hold a position in the world where we actually talk to each other and don't kill each other, and we reason and we debate and we have a degree of pluralism and all of these things, and that's a good thing. The question is, and I think that some of the authors you're quoting here raise this question, either explicitly or just in terms of their general argument, the question is, can that kind of middle position long survive the onslaught of seriously ideological people? Answer, no, probably not. History suggests not, right? We've been here before with the Weimar Republic collapsing into fascism and so on. And judging by what's going on now with regard to this serious principled philosophical nihilism, And these determined agendas that are being driven by people who know exactly what they're doing, I would not have great confidence in the ability of this rather fragile liberal secular humanism protecting the things which it values. That's precisely my point. You need something far more robust underneath all of these things that I think are good things. I personally think agreeing to live in a plural society and to debate and stuff is vastly preferable to killing each other. You know, I'm quite enthusiastic about that temporary solution to our political, you know what I mean? But can that actually withstand, say, radical Islamism, for example, or any other kind of radicalness? I don't think so. It doesn't have the resources within it. It's parasitic on the story out of which it came. It's living on borrowed capital, as it were. And it, unfortunately, historically, it just seems to take an awful lot of people an awful long time to work it out. Too long, usually, actually. Sadly. So, yeah.
Another one. Yeah. Parasitic. For sustenance, in fact, it's the other way around. So the stolen capital, like Frank talks about, the poor capital. My question is about, you mentioned the word secular, and humanism.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand there's a Christian tradition of humanism in the way we see it. However, and then the term humanism itself, should we now be, as we try to clarify terms, you know, to be more philosophically accurate in finer terms, should we typically say, like, when we know that somebody's talking from a humanist perspective, but it's actually a secular humanist, should we give the word, the pre-word, whatever you call it, secular humanism, and then should we differentiate that from Christian humanism? Or, because I think sometimes we don't want to confuse the two.
No, but on the other hand, we do want to have a conversation with people, and having a conversation with people always involves borrowing their language and their ideas, and for the sake of argument, acknowledging X, Y, and Z, even though later on you might want to discuss that. So conversation requires common language, and I am disinclined to give up perfectly good words just because somebody else stole them and did bad stuff with them. You know, I mean, you know, I'm quite fond of the word humanism. I think it says something really important. Conversely, I'm not awfully enthusiastic just at the moment with the word evangelical, for example. You know, because I'm sure some of you think the same. You'd be going, okay, that's become very loaded. I wonder if we might stop using that for a bit just to get clarity about what we're doing. I mean, I'm tempted to, this might be more controversial, I'm sometimes wondering even about the word Christian sometimes, for the same reason, right? It's interesting to me that the first Christians were known as people of the way, which implies a people on a journey somewhere, right? It's kind of inevitably active, as it were. The word Christian, of course, as you well know, is also used in an astonishingly wide range of ways. And, you know, it says, are you a Christian? Yes, but not the sort you think. Is, you know, you know what I mean, though? It's almost got to that, right? So with all of this stuff, and humanism would be a great example, I do not want to give up that word. It's a good word. It says something really important, right? That we and God, we because God, value human beings and a certain way of living as humans very, very highly, right? So, yeah. Yes, over here.
Thinking of God's commission to Jonah to preach to the Ninevites,
mm-hmm.
and the one of the last verses, should I not be concerned,
mm-hmm.
after Jonah's wrapped up about a vine dying?
Yeah.
It seems God's saying, I'm concerned about this plant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Should I not be concerned about the dignity and the worth?
Yeah. Absolutely, and that's a great example, and you get these examples all the way through Scripture of where the people of God are vastly less enthusiastic about God's mission in the world than God is. God turns out to be a much greater humanist than Jonah, and not just a humanist, because he also throws in the cattle in that. Did you notice that? Should I not have compassion because of all these people and all these cattle? Which, again, does speak to a larger biblical theme about God caring for the whole of creation. The fact that we're image bearers with a job to do doesn't mean we're the only show in town or the only important creatures, right? It just means that we have a particularly exalted position, but we also have a particularly high responsibility, right? And the two things are connected with each other. So that's a very nice example of what I would describe as God's humanistic commitments, if I can put it that way, for sure. I'm going to say somebody who hasn't, though, yeah, because we don't have much time. Yes, yes. Yes, yes.
I'm just wanting to know, because I don't really have any secondary educational background in explaining the uniqueness of, in particular, like the Torah, the law, at least the Ten Commandments. Mm. And from the impression I get is that it was very unique for its time, mm-hmm. and yet the people I'm conversing with, like I have a family member who is deeply not Christian, but deeply concerned about human rights,
mm-hmm.
And is also in law school,
mm-hmm.
and learning about this stuff, and I'm just, you know, working my job, and I'm just wondering if there are unique aspects of that law that I can bring up, like a very heard someone mention, you know, there's things pulled up by Confucius and the law developed by the Babylonians, you know, that they had a law system as well.
Is
that the majority of Western law bound up by those
right.
10 things?
Well, it's a great question. It's a question that requires a much longer response than 20 seconds, which is what that clock tells me. So I'm going to do a very naughty thing, first of all. I'm going to say, as it happens, I've written a book, which you can get in the bookstall out there, called Seriously Dangerous Religion, which explores what I think is a true rendering of Christian biblical faith in the context of other religions and what they say. So there's a chance to compare and contrast. We have to be careful in these areas because we don't want to claim as unique what is not unique and then people say, ha-ha, got you. You know. On the other hand, we don't want to underplay what is genuinely unique. So there are many aspects, and we've discussed some of them, of the biblical worldview that are utterly without parallel in the ancient world. But in the area of law, that is less so. And if you think about this, it's not surprising that that should be the case, because all of these peoples lived in a broadly similar geography and culture and all the rest of it, right? The kinds of things you're wanting to regulate are going to be broadly similar. And it's not very surprising, it shouldn't be surprising for Christians who believe we're all image bearers, if people's instincts and intuitions often line up. So that rules about how you treat widows are not so massively different in Babylon than they are in the Bible, because there's a basic kind of natural justice at the heart of it all. Now, so something like the Ten Commandments, they are much more unusual in their form, because they're not really laws, in my opinion. There are no penalties attached to them. They're not like what we would call law. They're more like high-level kind of principles of behavior. But when it gets to actual law about this happens and then this is the way you fix it, there's much more commonality, and I don't think that's very surprising. So I suppose the ultimate answer I would give you is a great question, but I think you want to go and find a good readable book that gets you into this, and I'm trying to resist giving a too nicely packaged an answer because that would give the wrong impression. Okay. Good. Well, thank you very much for coming. Our time is up. Thank you all.